With the concept of repressivity, we mean arbitrariness, jealousy, willfulness, lack of plan. The guards come out essentially to be not trustworthy. They come out to be a foe of man. Man has to either maintain himself by brute force, or he has to subdue his own will under the will of the gods. You can see that beautifully illustrated both in Greek literature and also in Oriental myth. Then the second point is what the political implications for our time are. Now, I must make one point right now here. In the concept Oriental myth, I am including the Old Testament. And this is what we got hung up on last week. With the word myth, I do not mean that something is not true, but rather that in mythological form, a basic truth of man is being talked about. And I will illustrate to you how the Old Testament participates in many of the stories which are told about in Oriental myth. I will call the extra-Israelite literature Oriental mythology, but a basic point, a basic contention that I will want to make is that the Old Testament derives much of its material out of the literary environment within which it has grown up. Without that parallel, I could not make the point that Oriental mythology and the repressivity of the gods has political implication for us, because we don't read the Iliad, we don't read the Odyssey, we don't read the ancient Greek myths or the Gilgamesh epic or other extra-Israelite literature in order to get guides for our political action as Christians today. But rather we read the Old Testament to gain guidelines for political action. The parallel between the repressivity of the gods and the repressivity of the gods in the Old Testament is obvious, and I will try to illustrate that to you. The parallel to our present time is that as the gods acted arbitrarily and willful once upon a time, so modern man understands himself to be subjected and repressed by the arbitrariness of structures that he has not created. And we have a strong movement for 200 years that illustrates that man feels very much this way, beginning at least at the latest with the French Revolution. In the French Revolution, we have what later on appears as pure negation. It is the first example of the attempt purely to negate. This is a concept that I derived from Hegel, to purely negate the past because it is considered to be repressive. Feudality, emperors, kings, the whole socio-economical structure of the time prior to the French Revolution was considered to be repressive and willful, and we must therefore eliminate and establish something altogether new. The Russian Revolution is another beautiful example, but I choose to include the development of science and technology as an attempt to eliminate the willfulness of mythological thinking and the inability to cope with that, with the willfulness, and with something that cannot be pinned down with scientific accuracy. So when I speak about the political implications, I do not only mean the broad political events that have come up, but rather I imply also the establishment of a scientific thought and an industry and technology associated with that, which makes it possible for man to emancipate himself out of willfulness and arbitrariness as nature or other forces have imposed it upon man. Now, if it is true that the Old Testament participates in much of its literature in extra-Israelite literature, then that is only the groundwork on which the Old Testament creates something altogether new, namely the concept of original sin. In the concept of original sin, man is made responsible for the evil that has come into the world. And this concept is very, very difficult to bear, because if you're not responsible, that's much easier, I think. And ultimately, I ask myself whether or not the extra Israelite literature is not much more helpful in many instances than the Old Testament's blaming of man for the evil that has come into the world. But we must exercise that through. In the last session last week, we got hung up on the propriety of biblical critical exegesis or the biblical critical method. I hope we don't get hung up on that this time. The beauty of the concept of original sin is to be explicated specifically in political terms. Point 2b. If you do not understand the various forces in society, the various forces in history, the various structures that have enslaved us in the last 200 years, out of which we would like to emancipate ourselves, if you do not understand them as by man's own creation, as having been set up by man's own creation, then we cannot cope with them. But rather, the concept of original evil as it has arisen out of the Old Testament makes it possible for us to cope with these structures meaningfully. In point 2a, I will try to point out what original sin really implies. It implies the possibility of forgiveness. And I will set up a formula: no original sin, no chance of forgiveness. And I call that falling out of word orientation, the fall into sin, because there we lose the relationship to God and the relationship of trust, and we fall out of it. And that's what the Bible calls original sin. Now, once we realize that we have fallen out, then we assume that it is not just a willfulness of the gods, but rather it is our own doing that we have fallen out, and that is essentially what the prodigal son realizes. He realizes that it is his own doing. He doesn't say, my wicked father is the one who has pushed me away, or it was in my genes, or I was bathed too hotly when I was a baby, that makes me think as crazy as I do, I can't help it. No, he says, I am to blame myself, not other forces which are in myself or which are in my environment have made it possible for me to act this way. So the concept of original sin makes it possible to have forgiveness, and the basic point that I want to make here is that this concept alone makes it possible for us to deal significantly with what we have come to understand as repressive forces in politics. I do not want to go into the field of politics too much, but I've studied political theory for some time. I've studied some sociology, and I mean specifically the neo-Marxist mentality, and possibly also some neo-romantic notions that we should push all of the feats of civilization aside and go out into the countryside, create communes or whatever, in order to get out of the repressive civilization. But I'm not going to go too far in that direction. Let me begin at the very beginning, point one, namely to illustrate what in ancient literature we have come to understand as the repression by the gods. I would like to read to you the legend of Thebes. Now, within the legend of Thebes, the play by Sophocles, Oedipus Rex, is a cast. I at first thought I should just tell you a little bit about the legend of Thebes and about Oedipus Rex, but I think I should just read to you this legend in order that we can understand what the arbitrariness and the lack of trustfulness of the gods in ancient Greek literature implies. The place of Thebes lay in the central plain of Boeotia, a part of the narrow tongue of land joining the Athenian country to the more northerly mainland. Here, under the guidance of the Oracle of Delphi, this is very important, the Oracle of Delphi enters into the picture of the foundation of the city of Thebes right from the gods, just like God, also in the Old Testament, enters into the picture of creation. Here we have a beautiful parallel between Greek mythology and Old Testament history. Here, under the guidance of the Oracle of Delphi, a city was founded by Cadmus, son of Agenor and brother of Europa, whom Zeus courted in the likeness of a bull. Now, misfortune befell him, that is Cadmus, even before his city was established. For all the trusty companions who should have been his first citizens were devoured by a fierce dragon which inhabited a neighboring glen. But Cadmus was a match for the dragon and at one stroke laid him dead. Again, the word of heaven guided him. Now we assume that both the fiery dragon and also the original word, which has come from the Oracle of Delphi, was at stake in founding of the city of Thebes. For the third time, heaven guided him, as it says here. The word of heaven. Old Testament also speaks about the word of heaven. Again, the word of heaven guided him, and he was instructed to sow the dragon's teeth, the teeth of the dragon that he has killed, in the ground prepared for his future city. From which seed there instantly sprang up a tribe of giants so fierce and fully armed that a deadly combat immediately broke out between them, that is, between Cadmus and this group of fierce giants. Now, let's just think what has happened. The Oracle of Delphi, or the word from heaven, has told him, look, you've had a calamity at the beginning, which is really also due to us gods, but we are going to help you. You take the teeth from the dragon and sow them, and then, you know, the city is going to sprout forth. No, the opposite happens. A group of fierce giants comes out. The gods prove to be absolutely unreliable. Absolutely unreliable. They do whatever they will, and they laugh at man. Man is just the laughing stock. He's being kicked around like a football. This is what the story of Thebes says. He trusts, like Abraham trusted, he trusts the Oracle of Delphi, or he trusts the word of heaven, and does what the word of heaven says, you know, sow the teeth of the dragon, and maybe good will come out of that evil. What happens? A group of fierce giants instantly comes forth and does battle against Cadmus. Cadmus, again, has to maintain himself over against this this evilness, and again, it turns out that he is strong. At length, five remained alive, and these, offering their submission to Cadmus, became the founders and fathers of Thebes to be. Now, note what follows next here. Beautiful parallel to what we read in the Old Testament, right? In the first 11 chapters of Genesis, as a matter of fact. Cadmus begat Polydorus, and Polydorus begat Labdacus, and Labdacus begat Laios. And to Laios and his wife Jocasta, a son was born. We have a little genealogy here, just like we have in the Old Testament. And one of the basic points that I would like to establish here is that there is a parallel between Old Testament stories and about extra Old Testament or extra biblical mythology. If we've gotten across this first hurdle, then we can say with some safety that we have mythology in the Old Testament. But some people at the last time got hung up on that. I hope you won't. Because I do not mean, when I say mythology, that it is not true. Now, the story continues. If you know the story of Oedipus Rex, you know that Laios and Jocasta are the parents of Oedipus. And you can see that the founding of the city of Thebes was a difficult time from the very beginning. The gods were against man all the time. It was an uphill battle for Cadmus right from the beginning. It was very, very difficult. And you can find this in mythology of other Greek and Roman cities. You just open the books and you will find it. Before even a name had been given to this infant, and to Laios and his wife Jocasta a son was born, before even a name had been given to this infant, indeed, by some accounts, before he was born, his life was clouded with the presage of disaster. Namely, for Apollo's oracle had nothing but ill to foretell of him. He was destined one day to kill his father and to become his own mother's husband. It's the oracle of Apollo that says this. Again, the gods are against poor Oedipus and his parents. Again, the story of the city of Thebes continues, and the question is, how are we going to get out of this wickedness on the part of the gods? Apollo's oracle had nothing but ill to foretell him. He was destined to kill his father and to become his own mother's husband. Could any mortal device be proof against the gods' predictions? Could any mortal be so presumptuous as to try to thwart it? Laios and Jocasta would so presume. One way alone offered any hope, more than hope, namely certainty. The child should not live. The son around whom the whole tragedy of Thebes turns, namely Oedipus, should not live, so that the whole community of Thebes could survive. A clear parallel not only to the Abraham story and Isaac, where Isaac is to be sacrificed, but rather also to Jesus Christ, to the story of Jesus Christ being sacrificed, one person being sacrificed so that many could survive. So this child should not live, which would give certain hope of redemption for the whole community of Thebes. They would not indeed take upon themselves the guilt of infanticide, but they would deliver the child to a servant of theirs, a shepherd, with orders to abandon the child on a mountainside, its feet cruelly pierced, and parallel to Jesus Christ's piercing of the feet, his feet cruelly pierced with an iron pin so that he might not even crawl to safety. This was done. But still the word of Apollo and human compassion prevailed. That's interesting, that human compassion is also very much a part of the story. For the shepherd had not the heart to leave the child to perish. Instead, he entrusted it to a fellow laborer, a Corinthian shepherd, beseeching him to take it away beyond the borders of Thebes and rear it as his own. The Corinthian servant of Polybus, king of Corinth, did in due course brought the child to his royal master, who, being childless, gladly welcomed the infant and adopted it as his own, giving it the name of Oedipus, that means swollen foot, because of the pierced feet, in commiseration for its painful treatment. Oedipus grew to manhood. He honored Prince of Corinth and loved foster son of those whom he supposed to be his true parents. But by chance he came to hear again from the mouth of Apollo's ministers, namely oracles, the terrible prediction concerning him. He began again to be persecuted, poor Oedipus. Again, as his parents had done, he sought to give lie to the oracle. He fled from Corinth, resolved never again to set eyes on his supposed father and mother as long as they lived, because he was to kill his father and marry his mother. His wanderings brought him to Thebes, where now all was calamity and confusion. King Laios had been killed by an unknown traveler on a lonely road. We have suspicion of who that unknown traveler could be, namely Oedipus himself. The city was in the grip of a deadly monster, the Sphinx, who pitted her ferocity against the wits of man, destroying all who failed to answer her cunning riddle. And none could answer it, but in Oedipus the creature met her match. Again, Oedipus, as Cadmus earlier, proved to be a mighty man. He was one of the great ancient Greek heroes, and he proved a match to the Sphinx. He solved the riddle of the Sphinx, he answered her riddle and destroyed her power, and so was received joyfully into Thebes as her king and heir to the house of fortune. A happy man, a wise and resourceful man, and save for one sharp encounter on his journey from Corinth to Thebes, a man of peace. He married Jocasta, and sons and daughters were born to them. Great tragedy, due to the gods alone, due to no man at all, but due to the gods alone. There passed some 15 years of seeming prosperity, but beneath the deceptive surface, a hideous depth of shame and infamy lay concealed, namely, Oedipus is the son of Jocasta, and he has married her, and he has killed his own father, and conceived children with Jocasta. The gods could no longer brook in silence the affront of Oedipus' unwitting sins. Pestilence and famine brought Thebes once more to the verge of utter extinction. In their despair, her citizens cried to their king for yet more proofs of his infallible resources, and to their gods, chief among them Apollo, for light and healing in their wretchedness. And here the play of Oedipus Rex begins, and you know how the story of Oedipus Rex continues. He step by step finds out the truth of what has happened, and when he finds out the truth, he knows that he is at fault, but only in an intermediate way, but rather ultimately, of course, the gods themselves are at fault. The gods have kicked him around all the time. Now let me just give you another example. At the end, incidentally, of the play, Oedipus Rex, he pokes out his eyes, and in order to illustrate how blind he had been throughout all of his life, and how now he has true sight, namely in his heart. That is the best that Greek tragedy can do for us. There is no redemption, ultimately. The best that Greek tragedy can do for us is to is for man to submit to the gods, and the gods' will, of course, is arbitrary. What a different notion we find in the Old Testament. Their gods' will is trustworthy. But I will get to that point a little later. In the second book of the Iliad by Homer, writing much older, in fact, around, we assume that it came, arose around 1200 BC, about the time when some of the earliest writings about Abraham, for example, and Moses have been written in the Old Testament. In the first book of the Iliad, a dispute between Agamemnon and Achilles arises. They are going to sail against Troy, and they cannot to retrieve Helen back. At the end of the struggle between Agamemnon and Achilles, Achilles makes a pact with Zeus that he would be avenged. So Zeus is going to avenge Achilles. Avenge Achilles and destroy Agamemnon. Now listen here. The second book deals with how Zeus beguiled Agamemnon by a dream, and of the assembly of the Achaeans and their marching forth to battle. Now I will just read the first few lines here of the second book of the Iliad in order to illustrate how willful the gods and arbitrary they act, and how they want to get even with men, and how they side with men and put one over on somebody else. Now all the other gods and chariot-driving men slept all night long. Only Zeus was not holden off a sweet sleep. Rather, he was pondering in his heart how he should do honor to Achilles and destroy many besides the Achaean ships. And his design seemed to him the best, to wit, to send a baneful dream upon Agamemnon, son of Atreus. So he spoke and uttered to him winged words, "Come now, thou baneful dream, go to the Achaeans' fleet ship, enter into the hut of Agamemnon, son of Atreus, and tell him every word plainly as I charge thee. Bid him call to arms the flowing-haired Achaeans with all speed, for that now he may take the wide-wayed city of the Trojans, for the immortals that dwell in the halls of Olympus are no longer divided in council, since Hera had turned the minds of all by her beseeching, and over the Trojans sorrow hangs." That's not true. That's not true. That's a pure lie. Agamemnon is to believe that the god, that the dispute among the gods is overcome, and that the Trojans are now in their hands, and that the Trojans can be taken. They just have to, you know, bring up the guts in order to sail against the Trojans. That's not true at all. But Agamemnon believes this at first. Later on, it turns out that they will not do as he had in his dream. But he argues reason, as the whole thing develops, reason enters into this argument. Agamemnon says, sure, the gods are now on my side, we can sail against Troy, and Troy is going to be given over into our hands. And then they argue, sure, it's reasonable, the Trojans are much less. Read these lines, for example, a couple of pages on. "For if by chance," this is what Agamemnon says to the soldiers, after he has arisen from the dream, "for if by chance we were minded, both Achaeans and Trojans, to swear a solemn truth, and to number ourselves, and if the Trojans should gather together all that have their dwellings in the city, and we Achaeans should marshal ourselves by tens, and every company choose a Trojan to pour their wine," that is, the Trojans should be their servants, "and if one Trojan should pour the wine for every 10 Achaeans, then would many tens, namely many of these 10 companies, lack a cupbearer. So much, I say, do the sons of the Achaeans outnumber the Trojans that dwell within the city." A good argument is added to the dream by Agamemnon, and it's just a dream that is going to lead them astray. The gods are plainly against man. The gods are oppressive, the gods are repressive, and man is just a football being kicked around. So I would like to illustrate how this, in fact, this remnant we find in the Old Testament also remnants of this. But the basic point, please understand, the basic point of what I'm trying to say is that the Old Testament used much of this literature and changed it into something altogether new that has never been written about in ancient literature. Another point I should make, this ability for man to assume responsibility makes it possible to become creatively engaged in God's redemptive work in history. Within the context of Greek mythology and extra-Israelite mythology, the best thing that man can do is grit his teeth and abandon the Old Testament reinterpretation, the beautiful theological construction of the concept of original sin makes it possible to assume full responsibility, namely to be man in the eyes of God, created by God, and then to assume the work of being co-creators in the world. This role man could never take in the context of extra Old Testament literature. Before, however, I get to that point, maybe I should get to point B, 1B, and indicate the political implications in our own time. No, I will give the Old Testament parallels first, I think. And here I must use the Bible. And I'm concerned now mainly with chapters 1 to 11 of Genesis. Especially Genesis 3 to 11, where the story of the fall began. In Genesis 2, verse 17, we read, for example, Genesis 2, verse 15. The Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, you may freely eat of every tree in the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall die. Here again is one of those illustrations of stories about the tree of knowledge of good and evil, or the tree of life, which we find also in extra-Israelite literature, where the gods keep jealously ultimate authority and ultimate power for themselves. They do not want man to be like God. Throughout all of this, however, throughout all of the Old Testament literature, we find the reinterpretation. But at this point, I choose to illustrate mainly the original very old stories about the willfulness of the gods that prohibit a man to do certain things. Maybe I should also quote from the Gilgamesh epic, as I did in the first session that we did last week. In the Gilgamesh epic, incidentally, we have this here in our bookstore and also in the library. It's worthwhile to read the Old Testament with the Gilgamesh epic and with some of the ancient epics that came out of the extra-Israelite body of literature that is now available to us. In the famous Gilgamesh epic, for example, the hero Gilgamesh, who is in a certain sense an Adam, Gilgamesh is asked by the gods, Gilgamesh, where are you going? The life that you seek you shall not find. When the gods created mankind, they also gave death to him, while they maintained life for themselves. Life and ultimate authority is kept for the gods themselves, and man is really just a football being kicked around. In the Adapa myth, another one of the myths that we find in the anthology by Pritchard on the text of the ancient Near East, published at Princeton University in 1959, Adapa is instructed not to eat and drink from that which can provide life alone. Now, the interesting thing is that Adapa obeys this command in the hope, based on the promise, that the gods themselves will give life to him. And what happens? The gods just laugh at him and say, ha-ha, you thought that we would give life to you because you obeyed our command. But we are not going to give life to you because we are going to keep it for ourselves. Now, all of this is present in the Old Testament. When the gods act arbitrarily, for example, in Genesis 2, verse 17, as I quoted to you, shall not eat of the tree of knowledge. Ha-ha, we are the ones alone who will keep ultimate knowledge and life for ourselves. The story of Cain and Abel. Let us read those passages. Genesis 4, verse 3. and four. And Abel brought of the firstlings of his flock. Abel is the second son, Cain is the first son. And Abel brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offerings. Why? Why should the Lord have regard for Abel and his offerings? And not for Cain. This is unjust. The gods act in an arbitrary way. Cain was the firstborn. He should have, God should have been especially mindful of Cain's offerings. But no, God chooses to look with favor upon Abel's offerings. The gods act in an arbitrary way. But you see, this is, I just want to emphasize that this is a remnant of the extra Israelite literature, and that the Old Testament did something altogether beautiful, for which reason I take these few passages out of context in order later on, when we get to the interpretation of the concept of original sin, to read the whole passage. Cain and Abel. Okay, the story of the flood. Genesis 6 verse 13. It says, God says, "Behold, I will destroy man with the earth in a great flood." Let's see, where do I have that quotation? From the text from the ancient Near East, there is a beautiful parallel. I cannot find it right now, where there is just such a story where the gods, out of sheer willfulness, choose to create a great flood and destroy all of man. Story of the Tower of Babel, Genesis 11, verse 8 and 9, probably an even more beautiful example of what I want to say. Verse 8 and 9. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the earth, and they left off building the city. Again, this wrath on the part of the gods. Why shouldn't they build a city? Why shouldn't they build a tower? Incidentally, no law forbidding them to do this is ever given. Whereas in the other stories in the Old Testament that you know preceded chapter 11, there is a concrete law given to prohibit doing certain things, eating from the tree of knowledge, for example. And in the story of the flood, it is said that man had done great evil. But in the story of the building of the great city in Genesis 11, there is no such law forbidding man to do anything. There is no such law that man should create a tower. Again, this is an example of how gods merely interfere with what man is trying to do. The building of a city, for example, as in the legend of Thebes, there is a beautiful example and parallel that the gods simply want to interfere and destroy anything that man is doing. In the Abraham story that follows, Genesis 22 verse 2, for example, another example of the irrationality of the gods. Take your son, whom you love, your son whom I have promised to you in your old age, and offer him on Mount Moriah. You know, if that is nothing to, you know, if anything can be laughed at, it is this. Job is a beautiful story of the, you know, if looked at from this perspective of the vindictiveness of the gods. The whole book of Job is a beautiful example of this ancient notion of the vindictiveness of the gods. But please, I must make a footnote right here all the time. What a beautifully different thing the Old Testament has done with Job. Job trusts God throughout all of his life. Abraham trusts God despite this vindictiveness. God is not really vindictive at all. It says at the beginning that God wanted to test Abraham. But you see, that was added later, I suspect. I just think that here, in the idea of offering your son for whom you have waited a long time, there is a very, very old story trying to illustrate how vindictively the gods act. Okay, now that I have given parallels, I think it is clear what I mean that ancient man felt himself repressed by the gods. Now, the parallel for the political implications of our time today. Now we have all last week debated these issues, especially with our Pitcher. we have carried on a Christian Marxist dialogue here. We have three sessions which were signed out by a hammer and sickle on the bulletin board. Marxism is one of those great forces that tries to eliminate the great evil of oppressive posterity. And for that reason, Marxism is one of those forces that tries to eliminate this repressivity. And in this context, I would like to cast some of the problems that confront us now. Modern man feels himself oppressed like ancient man feels himself oppressed. As modern man tries to maintain himself over against the vindictiveness of the gods, so also ancient man has done. The French and the Russian revolutions are only one example. It is not our reason which is at fault, but rather the irrationality of political structures that have been created in the past that is at fault for the inhumanity that has come down upon us. Therefore, we must create a great revolution and maintain ourselves. It is not our fault, but rather their fault. It is not our humanity, but rather their inhumanity, the inhumanity of those that have come before. It is not our fault that so many people in the West are suffering in the cities, slums, for example, the Russians are saying, it is not our fault that they are suffering, but rather the fault of capitalism. Therefore, we must create a revolution. The present poverty in Asia and in South America, we tend to say it is not our need for cheap labor and raw products, but rather it is their own sloth. It is their laziness that has made them so poor. We only bring our technology in and create the ability for them, for countries, developing countries in Asia, Africa, and in South America. We bring in technology and money for them to be able to develop themselves. We are for the good. When they don't do anything with it, that's their own fault. They are lazy, they are slothful, they're stupid. They have no education. That tends to be the way we are thinking. It's their own fault. As far as the revolutions in Cuba and South America and Vietnam and Africa is concerned, we tend to say it is not our blindness to the real poverty and our exploitative politics that take place, but rather it is their ideology. It is the evil ideology that has grown within those countries. And the dehumanizing policies of the ideologies that have brought about these revolutions. As far as poverty in our cities, slums, the breakup of the families in our own civilization is concerned, we tend to say it is not our clean suburbs. It is not our intelligent and well-educated whites. It is not this huge street cruisers that roam through the country, which make new highways more and more necessary, that devastate the cities because everybody's moving out of the cities. It's not our reasonableness that is at fault for all of the poverty in our cities and slums and the breakup of families, but it is rather the lack of the initiative among those who live in the slums. It is the lack of education and the sheer stupidity. It is not, as far as alienation in modern commerce and industry is concerned, we tend to say it is not our jobs and wages providing factories. It is not our big corporations, it is not our big business that creates this alienation, but it is rather technology. We can't do anything about it. Technology is independent from us, it does things by its own, we are not responsible. These things, just to illustrate on point number 1b, what I mean with political implications of this repressivity. If we don't read the Old Testament in the light of alienation, in the light of the repressivity that takes place in our society, I think we miss the whole point altogether. Okay, now we come to point number 2. The Old Testament reinterpretation of the ancient myth, and here is probably the most difficult part of what we try to do. At the beginning, I have, that is in point 1a still, trying to show the Old Testament parallels to the Greek and extra Old Testament Oriental myth. I try to show that these same elements are present also in the Old Testament, these same elements of the repressivity of the gods. But the Old Testament does something beautiful and altogether different. It fixes blame squarely on man. So it does not share the myth of the Old Testament, but rather changes that myth. Man himself is now made the author of evil in the Old Testament and not the gods. It's not the gods who are at fault, but rather it is man himself. story of Adam and Eve, the story of Cain and Abel, the story of the Tower of Babel. Man is the one who tries to put himself into the center and eliminates God from his desire to be a guide to man. Now, how does evil begin? Point 2a. It begins with doubt. It is, I think, very significant that it is not God, it is not man that brings evil about, but rather it is the snake. What is the snake? The snake is the most lowly of animals that can't even talk. Evil just happens. But the point is that it happens because of man. And the evil stands for reason. The evil stands for reason, which intrudes into the harmony of the paradise of the Garden of Eden. The snake says, could it possibly be that God is so arbitrary as to forbid you to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Because if God wants you to do good, then certainly you must know what the good is. So it would be all in your favor, and certainly you will not die if you eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, but rather you will become like God, and God is has eternal life. And Eve is convinced by that story, and Eve plucks from the tree, and indeed, what the snake has said seems to be true, because Adam and Eve do not die. In fact, they become like God. So what's the whole point? The snake seems to be right. The Old Testament, however, does something altogether different. In Genesis 3, where we hear about the story of Adam and Eve plucking from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we hear that doubt creeps in and the world orientation is broken up. Man is created by the word as the whole universe is created by the word. That means that man is created by God to stand over against God in a speaking relationship. As soon as doubt creeps in, as soon as man asks himself, well, maybe it isn't quite so logical what God has said. I think it is not all that logical. Maybe we should eat from the tree of knowledge and good and evil despite God's command. So they do that. And Adam and Eve continue to live, as the snake in fact has said, but not because God doesn't want to kill man. He would perhaps have liked to, but because God is gracious. He does not want to break off the relationship of trust. If man has not trusted God, God is not going to cease trusting man. Now, Adam and Eve realize that, and the sign of that realization is shame. They are shameful, but shame is the first step towards reconciliation. So understanding evil, that is, understanding man to be the author of evil, is the first step to reconciliation with God. Because as soon as man understands himself to be the author of evil and to have fallen away from God, he is shameful, he feels guilty for that act of falling away. And that is already almost like coming back to God, like the prodigal son. When he has come, he has gone away into the wilderness and has squandered all his money. He does not say, it is my father, my family environment, and my, the square atmosphere, the repressive atmosphere in my father's house that has made it necessary for me to break away. No, he says, I am a poor sinner. How good could I have had it if I would have just stayed with my father? I'm not worthy to be my father's son. I will just be one of his servants and eat, even if it means eating what the swine are eating. I just want to go back. And the faithfulness on the part of the father has always been identical. The father has never wavered in his faithfulness. How different an image of God is this that we find in the Old and also in the New Testament in comparison to that which we find in the Old Testament, but specifically in outside of the Old Testament. It's a God who is trusting, but that means that evil can ultimately not be explained. Evil cannot be explained in the Bible. If you explain it, for example, as the Greek mythology that I've read to you does it, if evil is explained, then it is explained away, and then there is no creative exodus out of this tragedy. And if there's no creative exodus, you can't do anything with your life. You just live under the hammer blows of fate. How different does the Old and the New Testament interpret human history? It interprets it as continuous, as meaningful, but that means that you must put blame somewhere and not on God, because God is the author of all of that meaningful continuity. So it is not explained, but rather you understand yourself to be the author of evil. And as soon as you do that, you create the basis for reconciliation. Just one more thought. Supposing the snake would have been right, I assume that the emancipatory movement of our own time is also correct. If the idea of doubt, of doubting the providential guidance of God could be correct, could be incorrect, if that notion could be incorrect, then the only thing that we can do is to eliminate any of the notions that we have inherited from our past history, which in fact may be repressive. And then we must emancipate ourselves out of that, and that means that we emancipate ourselves also out of the world relationship to our own past that we have, because we Christians believe that this own past that we have, this history, is God's history with us. Then we must indeed emancipate ourselves out of that, and we find no God behind that world. Now, with the development of modern science, with the development of the critique of religion in Feuerbach and Marx, the emphasis is said that man must create himself in his own image. And he must eliminate any religious vestige. When Carol Hinderly gave the other night a Bible discussion, he talked about a psychiatrist in North Dakota who said that religion is wicked, religion is evil, because it makes man feel guilty. Yes, indeed. That's quite a correct observation. And Carol's point, of course, was that he misunderstands, this psychiatrist misunderstands altogether the joy of redemption. He only sees the law of the Bible, but he doesn't see the joy of redemption. That's correct. But the psychiatrist has seen something that was quite correct. The Bible fixes blame on man and makes man feel guilty. And what a different world the world would be if guilt could not be affixed someplace. Because if that were not the case, then we would have to turn around, as the Greeks had done, and say, how is can the evil be explained? Only from God. The snake is just interposed in the Old Testament because of the embarrassment of not being able to fix guilt immediately. You must get the process of thinking about how evil came into the world going sometime. And the snake is a handy tool to get that going. But the basic point that I want to make at the end now, and maybe you want to discuss perhaps tomorrow or a little bit later if we have time, what the political implications might be. Or maybe you want to discuss also this whole process of how evil came into the world. But the basic point that I would like to make is that if the snake could be correct, and if the gods merely act in a vindictive way, and if there is no reason to God's command not to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, then you have already taken the first step out of the world relationship. You are no longer in a relationship of trust to God, but rather you employ reason in order to ask reasonably behind God's will, what could God have possibly intended with us. As I was preparing for this, and I've been pondering about this for days, I asked myself for a parallel. Supposing a couple is closely before divorce, prior to divorce, what happens? No statement that one partner or the other partner makes is trusted anymore. You always assume an evil intention behind it. Such a couple has fallen altogether out of a relationship of trust, and they are incapable of assuming guilt for themselves, which drives the relationship apart. But rather, as soon as you do fix some blame on yourself, which there surely is in a couple that is about to break apart, If you only fix a little bit of blame on yourself, then you have created a little bit of a communication again between the two partners. That's what the Old Testament means. When it wants to say that man is responsible, he has fallen out of the God relationship. And he is to blame. The beauty of the Old Testament has been, especially Genesis 1 to 11, that these extra Israelite stories have been reinterpreted so that not God or the gods are to be blamed anymore for the evil that befalls man, but it is rather man himself. And this is the first step to reconciliation. Now the basic thesis is that if we do not fix blame for man for those things that are repressive in our culture and our civilization, then we are not capable of dealing effectively with them and of eliminating that repressivity in our civilization. Thank you.